This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
The fall in house prices is a good thing and should be celebrated. They are not my words. They are the words of one of Australia's best-known independent economists, Saul Eslake. Is Saul right or wrong? I'm Mary Guerin. This is The Conversation Hour, and Saul Eslake will join me. He says interest rates were already softening the market in Melbourne before the federal government's proposed tax changes. That is getting some backlash, of course. But he says that's all good. He argues prices coming down is good because housing is primarily a basic human need and not primarily a way to accumulate wealth. And that is why falling house prices will basically change the ledger. Is he right or is he wrong? Join the conversation. Tell me what you think. He's coming up very soon. Also, what's the most glamorous event you've worn op shop clothes to? Is it a cocktail party, a wedding, your own wedding? Vinny staged a fashion show this week in Footscray where the models wore clothes that were exclusively from Vinny's racks. And I can tell you, I've seen the photos. They look very swish. This is your chance to brag. Tell me about the biggest event you've attended, rocking your pre-loved clothes. Tell me about your best finds. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. 0437 774 774, the number to text. To join those conversations, the biggest event you've worn op shop clothes to. Also this hour, should Victoria follow the lead of New South Wales? That state has just allowed a certain level of medicinal cannabis that contains THC, that's the intoxicating compound, in their system. Should we follow suit? What difference would that make in your life? That's all coming up. So give me your glam op shop flexes. But next, the case for celebrating a drop in house prices.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Did we somehow lose our way with housing and make it too much about investment versus a basic human need? 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Or maybe you think we need to have the same tax breaks basically in perpetuity because that's the world we've had. Economist Saul Eslake argues we've been having things backwards for a while, so falling house prices is a good thing. He joins me now. Hi, Saul.
Good morning, Mary. Thank you for having me on your program.
You've always never shied away from a fight, but this is a provocative argument in Australia, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is, for precisely the reason that you described in the introduction. For the best part of 30 years after the end of World War II, Australians and both sides of Australian politics saw housing as something that met basic human needs for shelter, for security, and for a stake in the community in which people lived. And reflecting that view, government policy sought to increase the supply of housing, both by building more housing themselves. In Robert Menzies' time, almost one in every five houses built in Australia was built by a government authority, sometimes not very well built, and often built in locations that were a long way from jobs and without the services that we regard as an integral part of communities today. But they focused on increasing the supply of housing and making it easier for the private sector to provide housing for people who could afford to pay for it. But beginning in the mid-60s, and especially since the early 90s, Australians have instead come to see housing as principally a vehicle for accumulating wealth, or as they say these days, for getting ahead, without ever saying ahead of whom, but for getting ahead. And as a result, governments have increasingly done things that make it more difficult or more expensive to increase the supply of housing, whilst they have continually done things that inflate the demand for housing by allowing people to spend more on housing than they'd be able to otherwise, through things like first-time owners grants and stamp duty concessions, and more recently shared equity schemes and mortgage deposit guarantee schemes, and through lower interest rates and easier credit conditions. And we've got 60 years of evidence that says that anything that allows Australians to spend more on housing than they'd be able to otherwise results in more expensive housing and fewer Australians owning it. And so, you know, I had come around to the view that the reason why we would never solve our housing affordability problem was because a very large proportion of voters did not want it to be solved, because it would result in cheaper housing, that is a reduction in their notional wealth. And politicians from both sides knew it, so they kept promising things that they did at last year's election that would make housing more expensive.
Do you agree with Saul Leslake? Give us a call. Like Tony in Port Melbourne, what do you think? Hi, Tony.
Yeah, hi, Mary. I agree wholeheartedly with Saul. I think as a group of people, we get ahead of ourselves. We're a bit hedonistic in our attitude, rather than have a look at the simplicity of life. If we've got a house over our head, we should be happy. And if falling house prices means better access to young people to get in the housing market, that's good. And we should adopt an attitude of looking at the greater good of people, not ourselves, and lining our hip pockets. So that's what I think.
I guess that is the case, Tony, if you've got your own house already and you're in a good position. But what about people who don't, or who are, relying on it in their older life? You don't worry about that?
Yeah, I worry about that. But I'm worrying more about the younger people and their ability to access a house. Mm. And if house prices are going up at such an alarming rate, the dollar doesn't have the stretchability, well, we need to realise that we're all about passing the baton to the younger people, and they need to have the same opportunity that we've had.
Tony, Saul will be nodding his head in fierce agreement. Tom in Whittlesea, you'd like to weigh in as well. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Saul's correct. Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Fundamentally, housing is shelter. 1969, myself and my parents come from Ireland as migrants, lived in a migrant hostel for 12 months. Parents worked as labourers and bought a house 12 months later. What's happened? We gave so many people opportunity, but all of a sudden the policy focus shift within government, enabling only the rich and famous to buy homes.
Yep. Tom, thank you for weighing in. Saul Leslake is on the line, one of Australia's leading economists, and he is arguing, look, the fall in house prices is a good thing. Saul, most Australians aren't property speculators. I think that's fair to say. They
Indeed.
Only own one home. They've worked really hard to pay it off. Why wouldn't they want that asset to appreciate? You're talking about that intergenerational question, but also it's retirement security. What do you say to listeners who are asking?
I mean, you raise an important point there, Mary, when you say that most people who own property only own their own home. Okay? And increases in the value of your own home are really only paper wealth, in the sense that unless you sell that home, you don't actually have more money to spend. And if the value
reverse
of your
mortgages,
own home,
is that, does,
well, not many people have those, but if you, let's say you own a home and it's doubled in value and you're thinking of selling it to trade up, well, the house you're going to buy will have risen by at least as much as yours typically, so you're not really better off. If at the end of your working life you trade down, then the house that you will trade down to has also risen more in price, probably in line with the one that you own, unless you're moving to a cheaper suburb, or unless you're perhaps wisely moving to Tasmania where housing is cheaper, having made a lot of money out of the Melbourne house market. It's only paper wealth. The only people who might be worse off if property prices go down are people who own more than one home, who own an investment property. Now, they might have saved in that investment property for their retirement. If it goes down in value, they might be worse off. But what about people who've done the same thing in the share market? You know, if share prices fall, nobody says that they should get some kind of special tax concession because they've saved up in the share market for their retirement. What is so special about housing? And here another key point is that 80% of the money that is lent for property investment is used to purchase established housing. That is housing we've already got. It doesn't add to the supply of housing. It just pushes the price of housing up further. And by definition, when a property investor buys a property that already exists, he or she is outbidding someone who's trying to buy it to live in it themselves. And when that would-be home buyer misses out because a landlord can afford to pay more because they get their interest bills subsidized through the tax system by negative gearing, that frustrated home buyer has to rent somewhere. Mm. So when property investors buy established housing, pat themselves on the back and say, I deserve tax concessions because I'm increasing the supply of rental housing, what they're actually doing is increasing the demand for rental housing by exactly the same amount.
All the dominoes falling. Susan in Blackburn, what did you want to say?
Yeah, I just want to say I think it's a great idea that I think that housing is being seen more as a somewhere for people to live. And because I've got three children who all would love to own a home, they're all renting and they've actually recently all been told their rent's going up. So, you know, even trying to save for a home is a really big issue.
Are they watching now that house prices in some places fall with a little bit of hope?
I don't know if they are, because I don't think they even thinking about the possibility of owning anything at this stage. Cause, you know, and they're on reasonable wages, but just, as I said, just even trying to save a deposit is a very hard thing. The other thing I was thinking is there are a lot of homes here that are empty in quite a lot of suburbs, and they're actually obviously for investment reasons. And if, you know, there'd be so many more people who could be housed. I've got one at the back of my house where it's a unit and no one's living in it because I haven't lived in it for nearly 2 years.
Oh, Susan, yes, empty houses is just one of those other wrinkles in the housing market. Thank you for calling. Sri, you're in Dandenong. What do you think about this? Do you agree with Saul?
Yes, I do. I do very much believe in what he has just said.
Mm.
Totally.
Yeah.
Negative gearing and the discount on the CGT is absolutely ridiculous because it's only making the rich richer.
Yeah.
And the poorer, they have no way of advancing themselves. They don't even can't afford to pay for their own house.
Sri, thank you for calling in. Wow, that's a lot of people on your side, Saul Eslake. You'd be happy to hear that. Let me try to put the other side, maybe
sure.
Just through the political lens. Politicians, Jim Chalmers could never say these words, even with all these things going on. He'll never say house prices should fall. If a politician in Australia in 2026 openly campaigned saying, look, lower house prices are good, essentially using your essentially moral argument, that'd never win, would it?
Well, probably not, because most Australians now view housing as a means of accumulating wealth, and they don't want politicians to do things that might reduce the rate at which they accumulate wealth or even cause them losses. But
so it's become a cultural problem? And in that case, even if we enter this brand new world, there's a bit more of a level playing field. How long does it take to reverse that cultural expectation?
Well, it might be decades, Mary, but the way I'd sort of put it is a bit like this, that there are 87 different components in the Consumer Price Index, which we use to measure changes in the cost of living. If any of the other 86 components in the Consumer Price Index were to go down by 5%, that would be a cause for celebration, and the government would probably claim credit for it. But the biggest single component in the cost of living is the cost of housing, and we look at that through the opposite lens to which we look at every other of the 86 items in the CPI. And we saw this in the election last year, right, which was about the cost of living ostensibly. And the biggest component of the cost of living is the cost of housing. But both Peter Dutton and Anthony Albanese said to voters during the election campaign, we want house prices to keep going up. And they both offered policies designed to produce that result, house prices going up. And you're right that Jim Chalmers can't bring himself. Claire O'Neill, the housing minister, was being interviewed on the ABC by David Spears on Sunday. Mm. She could not bring herself to say that the solution to the problem of housing being too expensive is cheaper housing.
That's right.
That's what we would say about, you know, people want cheaper groceries, they want cheaper petrol, they want cheaper clothing, they want cheaper health insurance, they want cheaper airfares.
But a house has a unique...
to say, even though it's the biggest item in the cost of living, we have this massive double standard at the heart of our culture.
Heart of it. You're listening to Saul Eslake. We're talking about whether a fall in housing prices is a good thing. Angela in Rosebud, what do you think?
I'm just wondering how many people are struggling to pay their mortgage, and if the house prices go down and they have to sell out, then they're going to owe more than what they've actually got equity in the house. Mm. What happens then? They go on the streets.
What do you say to that, Saul, to Angela's question?
That's a legitimate concern that Angela raises. It's called negative equity, and lots of people fell into negative equity in the United States in the lead-up to the global financial crisis, defaulted on their mortgages, and that helped precipitate the global financial crisis. Now, yeah, there are some differences between Australia and America in the way the mortgage system works. In particular, in America, it's much easier to walk away from a mortgage when you are in negative equity without the other consequences than it is in Australia. But the point is that negative equity is really only a problem if you have to sell. And if you don't have to sell, it might feel bad that your mortgage is bigger than the value that your property is worth. But history says that over the period for which most people own their homes, which is typically around 8 to 10 years, the price will go up over time.
But is that based on that scale which you have come to say is a problem? You know, if the prices are not going to be as out of control, then they may not get that money back if they stay longer.
Let's say to take forecasts that are being tossed around at the moment, that house prices could fall by somewhere between 5 and 10% over the next 18 months to 2 years. And if that happens, it will probably be at least as much due to higher interest rates as it will be to any change in the tax system.
Right.
That's over a couple of years. If you own your property for, say, 8 to 10 years, my guess would be that you might go down 5 to 10% in the first couple of years, but you would go up by more than that over the following 6 to 8 years, and you mightn't make as big a profit. But then when you trade up to the next house, which is why most people do sell a house, then the house you buy will be cheaper as well. Mm. And that's why I say if you only own one house, then changes in the value of it are really only on paper rather than actual wealth. And you know, we seem to lose sight of that. The negative equity is only a problem if, for example, you lose your job and you can't afford to service the mortgage, or if your relationship breaks down and you split up and you have to sell the house as part of a property settlement, then it's
and
a problem.
And then you can't
then.
Really choose that timing.
Right.
Yes. Barry from Beaumaris, you wanted to weigh in?
Hi, Saul. Thanks for coming on board. One of the things that's missing in all these conversations, or actually a couple of things, but one particularly, is the impact of these tax changes to renters. Now, there's 3 million renters in Australia. If the investors cease to enter into the market, and we shouldn't demonise investors because they give a roof over the head of a renter, what happens to those renters? Now, there was an article in yesterday's Age property section that said that this will be disastrous for renters, these changes.
The second point I want to make
is that if house prices come down 10, 15%, which they could very well do, we also know that construction costs are going up as a result of the war. They've been going up probably 10% over the next year or so. There'll be no development, there'll be no building, and the shortage of houses will be more impactful.
Barry, thank you. So that's two questions for you, Saul, about the plight of renters and also construction costs leading to that supply question.
Right. So on the first one, I'll reiterate something I said before, that over 80% of the money that's lent to property investors is for the purchase of housing we've already got, established housing. And when a property investor purchases an existing house or unit, by definition, they are outbidding someone who's trying to buy in it to live themselves. So that while that property investor says, aren't I a fine person? I'm adding to the supply of rental housing. They're actually adding to the demand for rental housing by exactly the same amount. And if, as I suspect we will, there is less demand from investors to purchase existing housing as a result of the changes that were foreshadowed in the budget, that means more people will be able to buy their own homes and therefore won't need to rent.
And Barry's point about the rising...
About new housing, now that's a legitimate point, right? We want to see more investment in new housing, and the fact that the changes proposed in the budget retain negative gearing and the 50% discount for investors in new housing, whilst abolishing it prospectively for investors in housing we've already got, may well encourage more investors to purchase new housing or finance the construction of new housing, which would increase the supply of rental housing. And when we're talking about the impact of these changes on the cost of new housing, the impact will primarily be on the price of land, not on the price of construction itself. Now, he's right, the construction costs are going up, and there are things that governments, particularly state and local governments, could do by way of the charges they impose on developers that would ameliorate that, and governments ought to be thinking about doing that.
Yeah, that's part of the picture. Thanks, Barry. And John from Smythedale, we'll squeeze your question in as well, or your comment. What did you want to say?
So we're currently going through selling our house and then rebuilding a new one. And the other guy was right that the cost of construction is virtually the same as us who have established our house. So we want to downsize. We've got basically one house. It's really two houses into one. And we want to downsize because my in-laws have passed away and no longer living in the other side of the house. So we want to downsize and then build another house. And the cost of that construction is virtually the same as the cost or the value of our house. And that's because the cost of construction has gone up quite considerably. Mm. And the other thing is that with the land that we've bought, the cost of the land has also increased. And the cost of the government taxes and stamp duty on that were astronomical. Like, we paid $35,000 for stamp duty, and now because there's no house on that property at this point, we're also being charged a land tax of $2,000 a year.
Oh, oof. John, you're facing quite a few headwinds there. Saul, what would you have to say to John?
Well, I absolutely agree with him that stamp duty is a very bad tax and it ought to be abolished and replaced with a more broadly based land tax that includes owner-occupied housing as well as investment housing and commercial properties, and almost every economist in the country would say that. What I'd also note is, of course, that the changes in construction costs that he was referring to have occurred well in advance of any changes in the tax system that were announced in the federal budget 2 weeks ago. The changes to the tax regime aren't responsible for any of those cost increases that he was talking about. Mm. But the last point I'd make is, if I've interpreted what he said correctly, he's financing the work that he's doing out of the tax-free inheritance he's received from his in-laws. So, you know, and I don't mean to be rude or cast aspersions on him, but he's in a much more advantageous position as a result of having received a tax-free inheritance from his in-laws than a lot of other people who are contemplating moving house or building a new one are.
Any comment from you, John, before I let you go?
First of all, we didn't get any tax-free inheritance because I paid for the extension on the house, so that was all us. So there was no, we don't have any inheritance that came through from it or a tax-free inheritance. We basically said, you come and live with us and you can live with us.
Yeah.
Basically,
but you're getting the proceeds of the sale of the property to which you paid for the extension, but not for the original house and land.
Oh, look, and I think obviously this isn't about John and John's position so forth. Thank you, John, for weighing in, because I think you've painted a really good picture of the complexities at certain times. But Saul, there's a lot of support coming through for you. You have still taken this on in a way that politicians won't. I'm sort of tempted to ask you, obviously you've argued for this a long time, you would also accept this in your own life. Your house drops 10 or 15% in value. You think, you know what? That's good. That's a good thing.
Yeah, it doesn't affect me at all because I'm not planning to sell it. My kids might get less when they inherit it, but they will still be getting a lot by average standards to which they've contributed nothing. You know, it's not as if they've borrowed any money. They'll inherit it. They won't pay death duty on it. They've got no, I mean, we keep saying to our kids, we're going to give half our money away to the dogs and cats home anyway. So whatever they got, whatever they get, they'll be doing very nicely out of, I hope, like, you know, I think it was Susan who was on before who has three kids who are looking to buy their own home. My daughter's 24. She works as a social worker, so she's not getting paid a particularly high wage. She wants to own her own home and spends a lot of time worrying whether she ever will. My son, who's 18, who's just started, he's come over back straight to do law commerce at Monash. He's probably going to have a better chance of buying a home on his own, but he's going to be doing it at a much older age than I bought my first home.
Yes. So, yes, the generation's still wanting what we wanted, but it'll just be a slightly different landscape. Saul, it's always fascinating to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Really enjoyed it.
Saul Eslake, with that conversation, what do you think? Keep those calls and texts coming. This on text, well said, so great to hear the inconvenient truth on greed and a sense of entitlement and highlighting shelter, advocating for young people without mum, the bank of mum and dad. Yes, they are lucky if they do have that bank, of course. And another one, I agree 100% with Saul. I own two houses, not government assisted, still very happy to see prices fall. People need houses, rent, buy, whatever. I don't want to shut them out. We will continue that conversation on the Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Coming up next, have you been prescribed or anyone you know been prescribed medicinal cannabis that contains THC? That's the compound, of course, that leads to intoxication or a high. As it stands in Victoria, we have zero tolerance for THC on the roads. We have an allowable amount of alcohol in our system, but not THC. New South Wales has just made the decision to have an allowable amount of THC in drivers' systems. Should that happen here?
Adventure awaits Little Ears with free audiobooks.
Most intriguing.
Like the 13-story treehouse.
How do you turn this thing off?
And The Wind in the Willows.
The best stories in the world.
Find free audiobooks for Little Ears on the ABC Listen app.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Also, a reminder, a time to brag coming very soon. What's the most glamorous event you've worn op shop clothes to? I want to hear about those fantastic bargains that you took to a highfalutin event. Maybe you did let on, maybe you didn't let on, where you've rocked your pre-loved clothes. We're talking about that because Vinnie's staged a fashion show this week in Footscray and came up with some pretty snazzy outfits. So 1300 222 774 is the number to join that conversation. But next, we're looking at the issue of allowable THC, that's the compound in medicinal cannabis. At the moment in Victoria, drivers cannot have that in their system if they are pulled over and tested. New South Wales has agreed to put a very low threshold where drivers won't face charges. Joining me now is Associate Professor Michael Fitzharris from the Accident Research Centre at Monash. We wanted to look at the evidence around THC and what he thinks of this move. Thanks so much for joining us, Michael.
No problem. Good morning, Mary.
Join the conversation, 1300 222 774. If you have been prescribed medicinal cannabis with THC, is this what you'd like to see in Victoria? What effect would that have on your life or if that's someone that you love? Give us a call. Michael, what is your response to New South Wales' move?
I think what they're trying to do is to navigate a really complicated issue and balancing the road safety risks associated with THC, and in this sense it's prescribed medically, with the interests and ability of people who are on that prescription, who have been prescribed cannabis for medical use, to ensure their mobility without being automatically penalised. So I think it's a system that they're trying to have really strong guardrails and safeguards. So as I say, really navigate what is a really complicated issue since medical cannabis was allowed in Australia since 2018.
Mm. And to be clear, there are guardrails around this, which we'll get to in a minute, but talking about the exact level of how much THC New South Wales is allowing in the saliva, it's 50 nanograms per milliliter. That means nothing to me, Michael, but what it effectively means is apparently if you have it the night before, and that could be as little as is left the next day, that's deemed safe. Is that a magical number for you?
Well, I think it's around what the evidence says about balancing, again, what the risk is and what we can see in the research. And I think what's really important to understand is CBD, which is known as medical cannabis, is not tested for at the roadside. But some of those products do have THC in it. And then we have THC-dominant medical cannabis products. So I think what that level is sort of saying is, based on all of the research that we see, that aligns with a period of time, depending on your dose, and that's a really critical thing. So depending on how much medical cannabis you take and when you take it, when you will be above a set threshold. And we know that there's around a 4 to 6 hour window, depending on your level of dose, where we see very clear performance impairments in the skills needed for safe driving. So reaction time is affected, decision making is affected, your peripheral vision is affected. We know that to be time limited, and saliva testing is a really clever way, because of the way cannabis, you know, THC works in the saliva, to capture that period of time. And advocates will always say, oh no, it stays in your system for a long time. That's true of blood testing and urine testing, but that's a completely different what we call matrix, and it's not used at the roadside. So there's been a bit of misinformation around that. So where we see,
but can I just interrupt you there, Michael? Apologies, but so what you're saying is that it can hang around in your blood, but it wouldn't hang around in your saliva. And what you're saying is that's okay.
Yeah, so other jurisdictions, and this is where it gets interesting, other jurisdictions around the world, North America, Germany, even New Zealand, have set very clear levels in blood that if you're above, you have an offence. So what we've got is a situation for the first time where a level is going to be set or planned to be set in saliva. And other jurisdictions do use saliva testing as a gateway to blood testing. We're using that, and it's an extremely well-suited test to capturing recent use. And that recent use is very nicely aligned with impaired driving or performance decrements in driving. It's very clear in all of the evidence from studies in the Netherlands, some in Australia, many in Canada, many in the United States and Germany as well.
So this move by New South Wales is quite significant on the world stage.
Yes, it absolutely is. No other jurisdiction has set a level in saliva testing yet, but saliva testing is used in the commercial sector in North America. If they're positive on the test, they can't drive commercial vehicles. And that comes to some of the safeguards within this model. So that's why saliva testing is a really nice way of looking at it. And where that level gets set, that can be based in some of the research and the time frames. So that's a really important step, and it can give people some flexibility once they understand how THC works, what's being tested, how it's being tested.
Yeah.
It'll give some people some ability to drive without being penalised with what they think is nothing in their system at all.
Would it affect your life if we had the same laws in Victoria? 1300 222 774. Join the conversation with Michael Fitzharris, who's an associate professor with the Accident Research Centre at Monash. I do want to get to some of the safeguards that New South Wales has also placed around this, like you mentioned. But you are from the Accident Research Centre. What is the evidence around the presence, low presence of THC? I have someone who has said, I'd rather have someone with that in their system than using phones in their car. How does it rank on the risk list?
Oh, look, it's what we know is all the evidence. There's some meta-analysis that has been done that shows a 53% increase, up to a double in people's crash risk with cannabis. And depending how long you've got your eyes off the road, we see a fairly comparable risk, to be honest, a doubling with phone use and up if you keep your eyes off the road for a longer period. Of course, you're at much higher risk, and the speed you're going at, you cover a greater distance.
Yeah. Phone and use what about in the car versus and alcohol?
Eyes off the road is a disaster. Again, it depends on the level of dose and the timing, but again, it can be a little bit comparable. When you put the two together, THC and alcohol, it's an unmitigated disaster. So what we see is, you know, we would see at least a 53% increase in crash risk associated with presence. And we also see the more that you have and the closer you have driven to that time, the more your skills are actually degraded. I don't think we need to make it a competition between the contributing factors to crashes.
What no, we but need it puts to it do in perspective.
You know, it does make it fairly comparable to a greater than 0.08. That's what a lot of the research is saying. In lane weaving, we see at least a 0.08, greater than 0.05 performance decrement with THC based on all of the on-road and simulator studies.
So could you just explain that again? Not quite sure I understood. So the THC with alcohol gives a 0.08. Is that right?
Can be much higher, actually.
Does this test in New South Wales, do you know, allow for the combination of THC and alcohol?
No, and in Victoria and New South Wales and other jurisdictions, the penalties for having both are much steeper. So that's an important thing. Where this is important with the what's happening, I will say in Victoria there is discretion of the magistrate. If someone does have a medical cannabis prescription, they do get caught, they can front up to the magistrate's court and challenge it. And that's then up to the magistrate to make decisions around that. What New South Wales have done is they've said, we're setting a level. There are requirements that you have to be registered in a system that they've created. And that's what we see in some states in the United States. We also see it having a registration system in Ireland and other jurisdictions. So that's new to Australia as well. But this only will apply to people who are fully licensed and
registered
BAC
as well with their prescription.
Correct.
As part of it.
And that, yeah, that's a really important innovation, and that's not new to other parts of the world. Other parts of the world have a registration system with the transport department, and that ensures that the prescription is current and it's valid and it's been obtained properly from a medical practitioner or someone who can prescribe it. So that's one of the safeguards. The other safeguard, of course, is that can only apply to people who have a zero BAC and no other drugs present in their system.
What was that acronym, sorry?
A zero blood alcohol content.
Blood alcohol content, yeah.
Yeah, so they can have no alcohol in their system at all. So,
it really is to try and zero in on people who need to use medicinal cannabis. Chris in Pakenham, what did you want to say?
I've got Parkinson's, and it's inconclusive that whether it can help with Parkinson's or not, but it's definitely ruled out of at the moment because of the laws and dosage laws or any presence. And now I haven't smoked pot for quite a few decades. I'm 60 now. But,
so you're not talking about medicinal cannabis prescriptions or anything, Chris?
No, I am.
You are,
Yeah. But if I have medical marijuana and want to drive, it's not an option.
Yeah. And so how would that change your life? Would you, what are you restricted doing now that you wouldn't be if these reforms were put in place?
Well, I'd like to stop tremoring, shaking, like shaking and people looking at me and stuff like that, you know. I feel it's not very nice.
Oh, of course.
And help with the pain too, because of the constant tremoring through my right arm. It's very painful all day. For the moment I wake up, I don't tremor in any sleep, thank God. But but if I had some kind of, it mightn't be medical marijuana, but it might be an option that I can't pursue it at the moment because of the road laws.
Chris, thank you so much for joining the conversation. It's really good to get your insight. It is something, as we know, we're not just talking about, obviously, driving. We're talking about people's lives here, Michael. We should also mention that another part of New South Wales reforms is that if you do have the presence of THC in your saliva, you do actually also have an immediate 24-hour driving ban, mm-hmm. even if the subsequent sample turns out to be below the legal limit, while they're, I guess, testing it. Is that the theory, Michael?
Yeah, that's right. And we know, think of the actual saliva test has an inbuilt level that it also detects for as well. So they need to make sure that people, where they sit in the laboratory, once it's confirmed, where that sits, that it's not astronomically high. That's a risk management issue. You can imagine a police officer who finds someone testing positive. There's a few steps that need to go through. Also, seeing they're a registered user, seeing what the level is, we still need to manage the road safety risk associated with that. The person mm-hmm. that may be positive could be completely off the chart. It becomes extremely problematic for a police officer to let someone continue to drive and they might crash, you know, a kilometre down the road.
Of course.
That's an unimaginable risk that can't be tolerated. So that's around a risk management approach, and that's why this balance, when that laboratory test comes through, I'm not privy to the timeline of that, but I would imagine it would be quite fast how that works. And I think that's where these safeguards are important, that they are targeting people who are using THC in a medical way under doctor's orders with a prescription. And that's the important thing to also remember, is THC used recreationally is exactly the same chemical compound as that used medicinally.
But
the effects are the same, and that's the balance.
But then this is only for people without prescription. Michael, correct. I'm sure you and other experts will be looking at how this works in New South Wales and no doubt seeing if anything needs to be tweaked with these reforms into the future.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, as indicated in the New South Wales government press release, that in 12 months' time, everything will be looked at. And I think that's a really important step as well, to make sure that the level that is going to be proposed is the right level. Should it be higher? Should it be lower? There is some warnings that drivers can have. How is it working? And I think that's an important step, rather than just rolling something out, is to actually assess it in the future and make sure it's doing what it wants to do, and giving medical cannabis users an ability to drive with some controls, as well as managing that road safety risk as well. So that's where navigating this really complicated, difficult balance is really important. So looking at it in the future, absolutely vital.
Michael Fitzharris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Mary.
Michael Fitzharris is with the Accident Research Centre at Monash. Brian in Doveton, you use medicinal cannabis, is that right? What do you think of this?
Correct. Yeah, I do. So I had sleep issues and I went to my doctor. They gave me all kinds of like medications, sort of like antidepressant, like anxiety meds before bed. But I still was getting 5.5 hours sleep, 6 max. Mm. Now I take the medicinal cannabis oil and I get... Last night I got 8 hours and 55 minutes sleep. Uh-huh. It was amazing. And I wake up in the morning, have my coffee, and I'm good to drive. I'm completely normal.
Brian,
so I haven't at night. So by the time I sleep, it's out of my system.
Brian, I guess, yes, that's what you'd be saying if you're in New South Wales as well. But take care out there on the roads in Victoria. Thank you for joining the conversation, and to everyone who's been texting as well. There should be a legal amount of THC in one system, says Greg, and we're all for the reasonable enforcement of drug driving laws. And that's Tom's text as well. Coming up next, what's the most glam event you've gone with Op Shop clothes to? I want to hear about your greatest finds. 1300 222 774. We're talking about that because Vinnie's staged a fashion show this week, and I can tell you what the models were dressed in straight off the rack from Vinnie's was pretty swish. Tell me what you have been able to do, the places you've been able to go, the cocktail parties, the weddings, was it maybe your own wedding? Were you in an Op Shop bargain find? 1300 222 774. Joining me now is Charlie Spendlove, who's the group CEO of St Vincent de Paul in Victoria. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. I've seen the photos from your fashion parade in Footscray this week, and I'm telling you, I saw there were little tags left on them. They were the only things that convinced me that they were off the rack.
Oh, it was incredible. Absolutely. Yeah. I was there on the night. It was a very cold, wet, rainy night, but the queues were right out the door, and over 250 people packed into a beautiful bluestone hall in Footscray. It was amazing.
And tell me, this was a fundraiser, wasn't it? How did it go?
Yes, it was. So every year, a small group of our Dream Team volunteers from the West come together and put on a fashion show to support our fundraising campaign for the CEO Sleepout. And this year, we're hoping to raise $1.75 million to support safe accommodation for women and children escaping family violence. So really close to home for everybody right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And a good way to do it is having fun with Op Shop clothes. What have you done with yours? 1300 222 774. What's the biggest occasion? Was it a runway, potentially? Was it a wedding? Let me know. John from Maidstone, are you a keen Op Shopper?
You could say that, Mary, considering my entire wardrobe has come from Op Shop, aside from the obvious, the smalls I buy new, preferably.
The entire wardrobe, John?
Absolutely. And you know what? My partner is even more keen. We've just been to Brisbane and the Sunshine Coast for 10 days, and I estimated about 50 Op Shops throughout the trip, and we've just had 20 kilos of clothing arrive in the post that we had to send ahead.
Oh, that's fantastic. John, I confess I am with you. I love Op Shopping, and I love it when I'm travelling as well, because you get to see other places, other things that get put in. Did you get some? What was your best bargain?
I love my old vintage T-shirts. We both look for those, but I'm particularly a T-shirt guy. But I tell you, it's not just clothing, Mary. Artwork is something that I've bought a lot from Op Shops, like some really good quality Australian, Indigenous and international artwork.
Really? I didn't even think of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm not telling you where I usually find it, because, you know, that's my little secret.
Yeah, you don't want to. Look, can I take your number and we'll exchange some tips? John, thank you so much. Have you ever worn, I guess since it's 100% of your wardrobe, you've worn it to the most glamorous events that you've had to attend?
That's all I got in the wardrobe, Mary. Yep. You know, it goes everywhere. I've op-shopped all over the world as well. I've op-shopped in Fiji, in Tahiti, in Hawaii, in Aspen, Colorado. Everywhere I go, I'm op-shopping, mate.
John, you are an inspiration. Thank you. Tell me if you've got a tale to tell that rivals John's. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Charlie Spendlove is with us, who's from St Vincent de Paul, Victoria, that had the runway show. How hard was it, or not hard was it, to find really impressive stuff in Op Shops for this event, Charlie?
Oh, look, it took a few months for the volunteers. It's completely volunteer led, so they curate the pieces, they style, they even model, and it just was just an entirely creative, diverse celebration of fashion and community. We had over, I think we had models from 7 years old to 70 plus. It was spectacular. But as you say, the pieces were just so beautifully crafted, just outstanding.
I do recommend that people hop on the Guardian website. Actually did a lovely photo display of some of the groove. I had to really look hard. I think you did not find that at Vinnie's, but obviously it all was. And the way they put the outfits together.
Yeah, it's really great to just get creative. It gives you new ideas for how you can use all sorts of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Charlie, thank you so much for all of your work. I'm really glad that went well, and best of luck for all of your fashion parades.
Thank you so much.
That's Charlie Spendlove, Group CEO of St Vincent de Paul, Victoria. Lovely text here. 30 years ago, I met my future wife at a bar. The first thing I ever said to her was, "Nice dacks." She looked down at her flared tartan pants and proudly replied, "Got them from the Op Shop, and I've got them down to less than 10 cents a wear." 30 years later, she's still the beloved rock star of a wife, still the most gorgeous person I've ever met. Fred in Hawthorne says, "My wife's wedding dress and my dinner suit were both from our local opportunity shop when we got married in 1987. That is a glam event, Fred. That's fantastic. And this from Sharon: "My mother found a pretty white lace dress at her Op Shop. She also found a light blue sheet she wanted me to cut and stitch stage under the dress as the petticoat. It was her wedding gown and it turned out lovely. My matching dress as daughter of the bride was purchased from the same op shop the day prior. They are op shop wins. I am now very inspired. Thank you for the texters of some private little recommendations to me. I will follow up for sure. Thank you so much for joining me on The Conversation Hour. You can find it again on the ABC Listen app. Have a wonderful day out there. Take care.